It's sure good to see each of you this morning. I appreciate you being here. When David pressed on, when he was talking about influenza, when I was young, I remember an old guy one time down in East Texas said, I opened the door and influenza. Anybody ever hear that? Some of the crazy things you remember. In addition to those that David mentioned for prayer, my oldest daughter, Missy, who lives up in Portland, Oregon, has a friend up there that has stage 3 cancer, and she asked us if we'd ask our group to pray for him. So I'm going to ask you to do that. Remember him. I understand his wife and kids had just left him, and all this stuff came about the same time, and he's a young man. I say a young man. He's in his 40s. So, at any rate, remember him. His name is Matt. If you would remember him in prayer, we'd appreciate that so much. Well, I'm going to ask you to open your Bibles to Genesis chapter 10. And before I get into our lesson this morning, let me say that the Bible is a tale of two cities. It's a story about Jerusalem and about Babylon. When we go to the very last book of the Bible and we read in chapter 17 and 18, we read about the fall of Babylon. And we read in chapters 20 and 21 about chapters 21 and 22 about the eternal city of Jerusalem, the new Jerusalem. The old Babylon destroyed Jerusalem, but Jerusalem's going to be present when the old Babylon is destroyed in Revelation. In Revelation chapter 17, Babylon is referred to as Mistress Babylon. And it's referred to as the mother of all harlots and abominations of the world. Now, all of that has to do with idolatry. And every false religious system and every pagan system in the world came out of Babylon. And in chapter 10, we read about the beginning of Babylon. Over in Leviticus chapter 18, this is just representative of many scriptures that we read about. We read about a number of sins that the world has been guilty of. And we read how that the land of Canaan, he says, is defiled in verse 25. He says, verse 24, do not defile yourselves in any of these things. And he's talking about all sorts of sins that are gross sins and perverted sins. And he says, for in all these the nations are defiled, which I cast out before you. And the land is defiled. Therefore I do visit the iniquity thereof upon it. And the land itself vomiteth out her inhabitants. Ye shall therefore keep my statutes and my judgments, and shall not commit any of these abominations, neither any of your own nation, nor any stranger that sojourneth among you. For all these abominations have the men of the land done, which were done before you, and the land is defiled, that the land spew not you out also when you defile it, as it spewed out the nations that were before you. For whosoever shall commit any of these abominations, even the souls that commit them shall be cut off from among their people. Over in Deuteronomy, there are many passages we could turn to, but in chapter number 13, we read beginning with verse number 6, if thy brother, the son of thy mother, or thy son, or thy daughter, or the wife of thy bosom, or thy friend, which is as thine own soul, entice thee secretly, saying, let us go and serve other gods, which thou hast not known, thou nor thy fathers, namely of the gods of the people which are round about you, nigh unto thee, or far off from thee. From the one end of the earth even unto the other end of the earth, thou shalt not consent unto him, nor hearken unto him, neither shall thine eye pity him, neither shalt thou spare, neither shalt thou conceal him, but thou shalt surely kill him. Thy hand shall be the first upon him to put him to death, and afterwards the hand of all the people, and thou shalt stone him with stones that he die, because he hath sought to thrust thee away from the Lord thy God, which brought thee out of the land of Egypt, from the house of bondage, and all Israel shall hear and fear, and shall do no more any such wickedness as this is among you. And this is the deterrent effect of capital punishment. People hear and people fear. There is a deterrent effect. Chapter 17. If there be found among you within any of thy gates, which the Lord thy God giveth thee, man or woman, that hath wrought wickedness in the sight of the Lord thy God in transgressing his covenant, and hath gone and served other gods and worshipped them, either the sun or moon or any of the host of heaven, which I have not commanded, and it be told thee, and thou hast heard of it, and inquired diligently, and behold, it be true, and the thing certain that such abomination is wrought in Israel, then shalt thou bring forth that man or that woman which hath committed that wicked thing unto thy gates, even that man or that woman, and shall stone them with stones till they die. At the mouth of two witnesses or three witnesses shall he that is worthy of death be put to death, but at the mouth of one witness he shall not be put to death. The hands of the witnesses shall be first upon him to put him to death, and afterward the hands of all the people. And then we read over further in Deuteronomy. I won't turn there, but we read about the seven nations of Canaan and how that God commanded that they be totally, utterly destroyed, root and branch, because that they would have an influence upon Israel and lead them into idolatry. Now, that tells us, that links back to Noah's prophecy in chapter 9, where he said, "Cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants shall he be unto his brethren." You see, idolatry in the Old Testament was a capital offense. That was not only a capital offense, we might call it the unpardonable sin of the Old Testament. There was no forgiveness for that sin. You were to cut the cancer out. And Noah did not, when he predicted the future of the descendants of his sons, he did not cause them to do anything that they did, but he simply foretold how it would be. And he simply foretold that the descendants of one of his sons, some of them, not all of them, but some of them would follow after the lead of Canaan, that Canaan would lead the nations around him into idolatry. And then later, we find that in 2 Kings, that's the reason why Israel was sent into captivity, because they adopted the gods of the land of Canaan. They did not destroy them root and branch like God commanded. So, with all this in mind, where did all this idolatry come from? Where was the fountainhead of all this? Well, we look at the Table of Nations, and this actually chronologically comes after chapter 11. This tells us how the world was divided into nations. Chapter 11 tells us an explanation of why the world was divided. But right in the middle of this Table of Nations, and this is unique among all the documents of the world, you will not find a document like this that tells how the world was divided into nations. But it says in verse number 8 that Cush begat Nimrod. Now Cush was a son. He was the first son of Ham, and Cush begat Nimrod, and he began to be a mighty one in the earth. Now last week we mentioned that that word mighty comes from the Old Testament word Gibor, the Hebrew word Gibor, which was translated giants in Genesis chapter 6. And he began to be a mighty one. He was one of the early giants of the descendants of Ham. And he was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Now that doesn't mean that he came and walked humbly before God, but it meant that he did what he did brazen and open right in the very face of God. He defied God right to his very face. And so he was mighty before the Lord. Wherefore it is said, even in Moses' day, who was the editor of the book of Genesis, he said it was a proverb even in his day, even as Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord. And the beginning of his kingdom was Babel, which would become Babylon, and Erech, and Akkad, and Calneh. And today, Calneh, the ancient city, is called Nimrud, N-I-M-R-U-D. We have the name of Nimrod perpetuated in that name today. and in the land of Shinar, which was known as the land of Sumer in history. And then out of that land went forth Asher and builded Nineveh, and the city Rehoboth and Calah, and Rezin between Nineveh and Calah, the same as a great city. And here we have the first world empire of the world of that day. It was the old Babylonian Assyrian empire that would later be revived under Semitic leaders. So this is the passage that we're going to look at in preparation for chapter number 11. That tells us in verse 1 of chapter 11 that the whole earth was of one language and of one speech. There was a unity of stock and there was a unity of speech. Now, let's talk about a little bit about what happened after the ark was beached on Mount Ararat. From the time that the Tower of Babel incident took place here in chapter 11, from the time that the first skyscraper was built, from that time to the flood going backward, we can determine that from a man by the name of Peleg, and we're on a good leg when we talk about Peleg. Verse number 25, unto Eber, this was one of the children of one of the grandchildren of Shem. Actually, a great-grandson. I guess, let's see, he would be a son of Arphaxad, Sally, grandson of Arphaxad. So great-grandson, Eber, he was the father of the Hebrews. It tells us that unto him were born two sons. The name of one was Peleg, and the name of the other was Joktan. Now, in the days of Peleg, the earth was divided, and simply means that this is what happened in chapter 11 when all the earth was populated and the different nations went forth into all the earth. Now, Arphaxad was born 101 years after the flood. Peleg lived, or rather as 101 years, I guess, that Arphaxad had Peleg. Peleg was born 101 years after the flood. He lived 239 years. So adding that together means somewhere between 101 years and 340 years after the flood is when chapter 11 took place, the incident of the Tower of Babel. I'm going to say that it probably took place closer to the time of Peleg's birth than it did his death, because when Peleg died, that wasn't long before Abraham came to the scene. And we know there were several generations intervened between the time of Shem and Abraham, 10 as a matter of fact. So, probably somewhere around 2300 B.C. Now that gives us the time setting. Now after the flood, you know, the world was totally empty. It was an eerie place. I'm sure that the nights were very long. And as the animals went forth out of the ark and they went to repopulate. You know, they say that a lioness will have about 3 to 4 cubs every time she has a litter, and she'll have a litter maybe every other year, once every 2 years. They say that a leopard has one every year, and that a leopard will produce 4 or 5 cubs. So as time began to march on and these animals began to go out into the world was a lonely place. There were no people. You didn't even hear the sound of talking. And I imagine at night, it was a pretty terror-filled place. And you'd hear some cat screaming off out in the distance like some demon out of hell. Maybe you'd hear the growl of some old lion and it'd kind of roll and rumble out across who knows where like thunder. And it was a place where people probably talked in low voices. And it was not a place that you would wander very far from the rest of the group. It was a scary place. But as time went by and rivers began to go down and become more controlled, and all of that mud-thatched vegetation began to have some sprouts of grass that grew up. And then flowers eventually began to appear. And then one day a cry of a baby was heard. And the sound of little puppies and kittens were heard. And then, you know, it wasn't long before couples were courting. And then they were laughing. And they were quarreling. And they were marrying. And life finally began to start getting back to some normalcy. But then, those animals were multiplying out there. And you know, probably, there would be some patriarch, some head of the family, and people would kind of stay close to him. He would sort of be recognized as the leader of the clan because he was the oldest and he was the wisest. And then villages begin to spring up as the people would live close to that leader, and they would form a little village. And some of the first laws begin to come into effect. Probably one of the earliest ones was that don't foul the water system. Keep the water pure and keep it clean. Another law they probably had is that you don't stray too far from the village, and when you hear the drums start to beat, you get back here in a hurry. And mothers would tell their little children, don't you go out into the woods because some tiger may find you and eat you up. And so it probably was something along those lines. And then as other people began to move into the village that weren't part of the family, and as the man began to assemble him a group of hunters to protect the village from the wild animals, then he had a little army there, and as he subdued other villages, he would become a king. And then as a king, he would groom his son to take over for him whenever he would pass off the scene. And that's probably the way it was with Cush and Nimrod. Nimrod began to be a mighty one in the earth. When he started growing, he didn't stop growing. And he got bigger and he got bigger and he got bigger, and people began to look to him because he was their protector. And old Cush, he was grooming Nimrod. Now, I imagine as the Hamites and the Shemites were growing up together, that old Cush taught his boy Nimrod to hate all those Shemites, just like in a Kentucky feuding family, where they're taught to hate the Hatfields, the McCoys are taught to hate the Hatfields from birth, right? Yeah. And you know, that same thing is still true in the Middle East today.
Yeah.
In the Middle East, those Palestinians are taught to hate those Jews, I mean, from the time they're born. I saw a political cartoon one time in U.S. News and World Report, and it had the last Jew and the last Arab on earth. All the rest of the earth had been destroyed by nuclear war, and the last Jew and the last Arab were there, and they were sticking out their hands to shake their hands, but behind the back of the Arab, he had a lit bomb in his hand. You know, they never give up, do they? They are taught that from birth. And I expect that's the way it was. I expect that Ham's boys fought with Shem's boys. Don't you imagine that was probably the case? And he was saying, look at those little Shemites hanging onto their mama's apron. Look at my boy Nimrod. Nimrod, he's a man's man. And look at his arrows. Look at his weapons. Look at all of that kind of thing. And so he began to groom that boy for a future role to take over the leadership of the human family as it began to grow in size of population. Now, Nimrod would go out, and he probably would take a lion, and like Samson, he would tear him apart in single hand-to-hand combat. Or he'd take an arrow, and from 10 feet away, he'd shoot and kill a Bengal tiger. And he'd probably take a wild buffalo and break its leg and take him down. And he began to develop a name. He became famous in all the earth. Now, all this time, remember this, that from back in the Garden of Eden when Adam and Eve fell into sin and they fell from the position they were in, you remember that in Genesis 3:15 there was a promise that was made that there would be a seed of the woman and there would be a seed of the serpent. There would be generations of the serpent. And we know who the devil is the father of. He's the father of all liars. He's the father of all murderers. And he's got his own children, doesn't he? He's adopted them. but he didn't produce them, but he's adopted them out of the human family. And then there's going to be a seed of the woman, and the seed of the woman and a seed of a serpent would be locked in mortal combat. And the seed of the woman would be bruised, but the seed of the woman would overcome the seed of the serpent and would crush his head. That was the old prophecy. And so everybody knew that there was going to be a world deliverer. And I'm sure that even all during that pre-flood civilization, that was the topic that was talked about a lot, especially among the crowd of Seth, about the world deliverer. And everybody talked about it. It's probably the chief topic of conversation on the ark. And it was probably the chief topic of conversation after people came out of the ark. Who would be the world deliverer? And it was said that the line of Shem would be associated, the lineage of Shem would be associated with this world deliverer. But Cush was determined he was going to defeat that prophecy, and that his Nimrod was going to be that world deliverer. And so with all that in mind, remember that this world deliverer, this idea of fill the earth, you find it in all the ancient mythologies. You find back in Greek mythology how Apollo was killing the serpent Typhon. When Hercules was born, he was killing little snakes from his cradle. When Thor up in Scandinavia came along, he would take his mace and he would kill the gigantic serpent there. In India, Vishnu, who his avatar was Krishna, he killed that giant serpent. And all over the world, in Mexico and everywhere else, you read in mythologies of the world the story about a battle between two, a deliverer and a serpent. And those things permeate mythology. So that family who would produce this world deliverer would be the most famous family in all the world. The mother of that deliverer would be the most famous mother in all the world. The father would be the most famous father, and Cush had decided that his family would be the family. He would be the father. He would be the prophet, the grand prophet of idolatry. And that his son Nimrod would be the world deliverer, and that Mrs. Cush would be the mother. And so with all that in mind, bear in mind that there was a migration that took place here in chapter 11, but it was in one direction only. God had renewed the covenant with Noah, and he told Noah he renewed the Adamic covenant with him and told him to replenish the earth. Go out into all the earth. And back in those days, there was still all the water hadn't drained into the ocean beds yet, and you could still cross over certain places. Or rather, maybe it had drained, maybe it was lower, and then maybe it rose after the ice age. But you could cross over to Australia through Malaysia. You could get to America through the Bering Strait. And so this was before the ice age began to crystallize and take place. And then after those ice caps melted back from North America and from Northern Europe, then the ocean beds, they say, rose about 600 feet and washed out those land bridges. But before that happened, animals were moving down into Australia. That's how the kangaroos got there. That's how the Aborigines got there. You remember that song when you were growing up? About my boomerang won't come back? That he's a great disgrace to the Aborigine race because his boomerang won't come back. Anybody ever hear that song? All right. So you get all sorts of information and nuggets in this place. Now, during that time, instead of migrating all over the earth, it was going in one direction only. It says that the whole earth was of one language and one speech, and it came to pass as they journeyed from the east. Now, how could they journey from the east? Because they started out at Mount Ararat and on the slopes of Ararat and up into Armenia. And that's west of Shinar, the Babylonian area. So how did they come from the east? Well, I'm convinced from having done some reading back in my younger days and some research that I believe the Indus River Valley civilization, which is today in Pakistan, that's where the Indus River is, that civilization is probably older than the Sumerian civilization that we're reading about in chapter 11. So it would appear that Cush began to range pretty far away, pretty far out. He's going to defeat that prophecy of Noah. And so he goes out into the Indus River Valley area, and they found a civilization there, and there are bricks that have been found with no inscriptions in the Indus River Valley ruins that are older than the bricks that have some inscriptions, like Sargon of Akkad. He was the one that we have the oldest bricks from in Sumer. Some associated his name with the name of Nimrod. And so they left that civilization. For some reason, those ruins tell the story that that civilization flourished for a short time and then just up and died and disappeared for no reason. And it was a very advanced civilization. They had brick sewers. They had things like this. And that knowledge apparently came from the east across the Persian Gulf to the land of Sumer. They started a migration. For some reason, they left. Maybe there was a disease that wiped them out. I don't know. But they brought a highly advanced skill of brick making with them. They're baking bricks in kiln like we do today, whereas down in Egypt in Joseph's day, they were still using mud and straw to make bricks. They had a much more advanced brick making technology there in the land of Shinar, and they had asphalt that they used for mortar. So they were more technologically advanced than the Egyptians were at an earlier age. But before that, the Indus River Valley civilization was where probably they had gotten that and developed that. Now, remember that the pre-flood super-civilization was not able to be reproduced right after the flood, because when you have a super-civilization, you have to have a large population to maintain it. You've got to have a lot of specialists. You can't maintain a highly technological society with just a few people. You've got to have a lot of people. I tell people, as far as my engineering goes, that I'm a general practitioner. But when I need a brain surgeon, I know where to go find one. That if I need a specialist, I know where to find one. But that I don't know everything about everything in the field of electrical engineering. There are specialists who know things like that. Same thing in the medical field, right? There are general practitioners. We call them sawbones, right? And when they need a specialist, they go get a specialist. Anybody ever have a sawbones work on you? Well, you want a specialist working on you, don't you? So, all this technology resided in the minds of Noah and his sons. They've been in both worlds. They had seen it. But let's suppose that today we lost everything, got wiped out. We had no electrical infrastructure. We had nothing, and had to start over with what we knew. We may know a lot about a lot of things, but we won't be using computers for a while, because nobody's going to be able to make one, right? And nobody would have the batteries to operate one. But there was a tremendous civilization that existed before the flood. In fact, they find things that are called out-of-place artifacts, which is abbreviated uparts. And I've listed some things here that they found in strata, geological strata, that is below the flood strata, that don't seem to belong there. They don't know why. They can't explain why they're that low down. Normally, and we got a geologist back here in the form of Doug Atkins, and Doug will tell you that the geological column usually typically is supposed to be a record of the ages of the earth, and at the bottom, that's the earliest one, and that at the most recent will be at the top, and yet that column exists nowhere in its entirety on the face of the earth. It's really a fabrication. It all comes from the geologist, Sir Lubbock, and all those people that came up with this geologic column, John Lubbock. These things were actually put together, and they were theoretical in their minds, but they ignored the flood. They ignored that a great flood happened on the earth. Now, in 1968, in Armenia, 15 miles from Ararat, they found 200 furnaces, smelters, mouth filters, gloves, and tweezers that were in some kind of a grate of steel that were down where they didn't belong, down below the flood strata. Well, we know what the deal was. We know that Tubal-Cain had an iron and steel works going back in the pre-flood days, in the antediluvian days, right? Doesn't surprise us as Bible readers. In 1967, at Rocky Point Mine in Gulman, Colorado, 400 feet down, they found a human bone in a silver vein beside a copper arrowhead. Where did that come from? It's not supposed to be down there. I believe it was Calaveras in the very heart of the mountain when they were doing some blasting. They found a human skull. Where did it come from? It doesn't belong there. In 1851, at Meeting House Hill in Dorchester, Massachusetts, there was a metallic engraved vase that was dynamited from 15 feet below in solid rock. Wow. Right out of the rock. 1891, Morrisville, Illinois, a gold chain was found in a lump of coal. And coal was formed quickly by vegetation from the tremendous pressure of the waters of the flood and the sediments that were dumped on top of them. 1851, California, there was a six-penny nail, iron nail, that was found in a piece of quartz. In 1865, in Arbery Mine, Treasure City, Nevada, a two-inch metal screw was found in a piece of feldspar. In 1835, there was a nickel iron cube in a block of coal in Austria. In 1961, in Orlando, California, there was an unknown metal object that was found that looked like spark plug. In Baghdad, in 1900, there was a clay pot. This was in the land of Sumer. There were a clay pot, dry cell batteries that when you fill them with an electrolyte material would yield about 2 to 2.5 volts per cell. We get what? 1.5 volts out of our cells? And in South America, in Peru, they actually have found plants that predated the flood that looked like some form of a glider. We're talking about a civilization that for 10 generations, that the generations were almost 1,000 years long, they developed a super civilization. Now, as ages begin to fall off, and we find that they begin to drop exponentially after the flood, you know, memories are not going to be as long as they were before the flood. Things are not going to be remembered as accurately. And therefore, because of that, things are kind of going to get distorted, aren't they? That's what happened to all these religious stories that became later the myths of the world. So all of this, got to remember that as they're starting this new civilization, that things are not going to be what they were. They're not going to be able to recreate the super civilization before the flood unless they do it quickly while Noah's still alive and Ham, Shem, and Japheth are still alive, who have memories of that thing. And this is perhaps their last chance to get all of the world population that's growing and mushrooming under one central authority. And so they migrate to Sumer. And they have a migration into that land. When they get there, they're kind of like Brigham Young and his bunch of Mormons when they reached Utah and said, "Eureka, this is it. This is the place." They found a land there that would grow, would yield crops when cultivated properly 200 to 300 times what they put in the ground. How would you like to plant one seed and get 200 kernels of corn out of one? Or 300? And it'll still produce that kind over there if it's irrigated properly. It's the most fertile land of all the world. It's the breadbasket of the world. The Tigris-Euphrates Valley. And so this is where they migrated to from the east. And they dwelt there. Now they started out at first probably as a bunch of little mud huts. But it didn't take them long before they began baking brick in their kilns and making brick. And they said one to another, "Go to. Give way now. Let us make brick and burn them thoroughly." And they had brick for stone, and slime or asphalt had they for mortar. And they said, "Give way now. Let us build us a city. We're going to build a city like old Cain never dreamed of. And we're going to build us a tower. We're going to build a skyscraper. And the top is going to reach unto heaven. And we're going to make us a name lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. Now, Nimrod was involved in this expedition, as we read about in chapter 10. He led the migration. You know, any time that you have a migration, some person forges to the front. He forges to the top. And I can just see Nimrod as he is beginning to get up in front of those people, and he says, you know, he says, I believe in freedom. I believe in progress. And he says, I'm not like these Shemites that they think that you have to wait for heaven in some sweet by and by. I believe in having a little heaven on earth right now. And he says that you know me, and you know who I am. And he says, these Shemites would have you believe that we've got to walk by faith, that we've got to live by faith, and that we've got to serve some God that nobody's ever heard, that nobody's ever seen. And he said, what is that God? He says, what can that God do? Well, he drowned the whole earth is what he did. He couldn't even take care of that race that he said, I could do better than that. And he said, he'll drown it again if you don't watch it. And we're going to have to build us a tower. And he said, those Shemites would have you believe that only God can give you happiness. And yet, look at his man of faith. Why, he hadn't even been off the ark long enough for the ground to get dry before he got so drunk. He couldn't tell a keyhole from Mammoth Cave. And he said he got glorious drunk all over the... And he went out. And of course, that was told all over the country probably by his younger son. And he says, you know, what's this Shemite God done for you? What's he got? I'll take you to the promised land. I'll make you happy. I hate this Shemite God. I defy this Shemite God. And where have we heard language like that recently in the last century? Long about Germany in 1939, didn't we? We heard that kind of stuff. And you know, I'll tell you what. The prototype of Alexander the Great, Julius Caesar, Frederick the Great, and Napoleon, and all of those people, and including the coming Antichrist, is none other than this man, Nimrod. One of these days, if the Antichrist, you were to interview him, you know who he would talk about? He wouldn't talk about Napoleon. He wouldn't talk about Frederick the Great. He wouldn't talk about Alexander the Great. He wouldn't talk about Nebuchadnezzar. He wouldn't talk about Julius Caesar. He'd talk about Nimrod. This was the grand original right here. He's the prototype of the Antichrist. He's the one that's going to try to lead everyone in rebellion against God and under one central authority. And that's what we're seeing in our world today, aren't we? We're seeing in our world today that the world is trying to come together. There are forces trying to bring it together under one central authority to get the stage set for the Antichrist to take over and rule and dominate the world. And so that's what we're seeing in embryo take place right here in Genesis chapter number 11. We see that Nimrod is trying to lead the people together in an act of rebellion. In fact, his name means the rebel. He's the rebel against God. And he's doing all this right in front of the face of God. Now, what's God doing? What's God doing about all this? It says in verse 5, and the Lord came down to see the city and the tower, which the children of men builded. And the Lord said, behold, the people is one, and they have all one language. And this they begin to do, and now nothing will be restrained from them which they have imagined to do. With satanic intelligence and satanic power, there's nothing that would be restrained from what Nimrod could lead the people to doing here. So God says, go to. He says, give way now, let us go down, let us, this is the Trinity, go down and there confound their language, that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord scattered them abroad from thence upon the face of all the earth, and they left off to build the city. Therefore is the name of it called Babel, because the Lord did there confound the language of all the earth, and from thence did the Lord scatter them abroad upon the face of all the earth. If you want to unify a nation, and you want to have a strong, unified nation, the one thing that's indispensable is a common language. There has to be a common language. If you want to split a nation apart, you have them speaking every kind of language under the sun and not have them recognizing English as the common language, and you'll tear a nation up. You'll tear it apart. And there's people smart enough to know this. It's no accident that we're getting people by the floods, coming in here from all nations, kindreds, tribes, and tongues that are not assimilating and not adopting the, and we have to have bilingual education, and maybe trilingual education, and you know, you've got to have orderly immigration and orderly assimilation, and everybody has to be speaking the same language, or there'll be no unity. And that's one of the problems that we have in this country today. Yeah. And I think that, that's one thing that, thank God, we've got a leader that recognizes that. And, you know, one thing I was reading over in Revelation chapter 17, and I thought this was interesting. It doesn't have anything to do with godly leaders. But here's what it says. Notice, God's talking about 10 kings that will be in existence at the last times. It says, verse 17, God hath put in their hearts to fulfill His will. Now that's a tremendous statement. That goes hand in glove with the statement in the Old Testament that the heart of the king is in the hand of the Lord, and He turns it whithersoever He will, like you would turn a river of water if you wanted to change the water course. He wanted to change the direction the river flows. And you know, that's true. God is the one who is in charge. Believe it or not, He's actually the one in charge. A lot of these world leaders think they're in charge, but God can and often does put it in the heart of some of these people to do His will. In fact, He does it to everybody in the final analysis. And God has put into the heart of a man that's sitting in the White House to do His will. Thank God for that. I don't say that he's a role model most of his life that you would point your kids to, but neither was the baseball players, the football players of the world, right? Now, there today we've learned they had feet made out of clay. When I was growing up, I thought Mickey Mantle was just about as perfect as you'd get. I was really disappointed, and I found out he was a big drinker, and he had to have his liver replaced. But at any rate, there's only one that we can look to as a model, and that's Jesus Christ. There'll never be another like Him. And He may not be a role model, but He is in the right place and at the right time, and God has put into His heart to do His will. And so that's why I think that we owe Him our support. And so, anyway, these are the things that are taking place here in chapter 11. I've given you a couple of handouts. What happened to Nimrod? What happened at this scene here? This is one of the great battles of all time when the Lord came down. This was a crisis of the world. This was as much a crisis as there was in the days before the flood, because civilization was wiped out, and if God didn't do something right here in chapter 11, then there would not be civilization for long, because nothing, He says, would be restrained unto them. Nothing in wickedness would be restrained. And so in order to preserve this world so that a Savior might come and might die on a cross, God had to step in and do intervention. And one of the great battles of all time is going to take place. And you know where we can kind of get an idea of where this happened, how this happened, is by going back and looking at the old mythologies. All myths were rooted in fact at one time. But they got so distorted, and one people had one version, another people would come in on top of them and conquer this people and bring their version in, and they would get mixed and mingled so that you couldn't hardly tell how it all originated. But I'm going to go through that with you a little bit, but we'll have to save that for next time, because our time has run out. Also, I gave you a little handout here that tells you about the parent languages. All languages today come, and there's thousands of dialects and languages, come from only a few parent languages. Now, some of these you may read, like the Elamites came, and there was, by the way, the Shemites and the Hamites mixed and mingled quite a bit, and produced a group known as the Turanians. Turan was the land north of Iran, north of Persia. And that's where all these peoples came from that were Mongolians and Turks and Hungarians and Laps and Finns and Dravidians in India, bottom of India, and Basque over in Spain, and Etruscans that were in Italy. All of these aboriginal peoples came from a mixed group of Hamites and Shemites, and they were the original inhabitants of all these lands before the Indo-Europeans arrived. So all of this kind of thing, you can be looking at it, and we'll bring it back with you next Sunday, and we'll talk about it a little bit, okay? David, I'm going to shut her down right here. But. Thank you.